The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
Hi, my name is Dr. Joanne Liu. I'm a pediatric emergency physician, and I'm a professor at the School of Population and Global Health, and I am ready to start digging deep.
Welcome to Digging Deep, presented by ZenBooks and Abacus Data. I'm Mark Sutcliffe, and I'm on a quest to learn from the best. Throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, you and I and many other people have probably, at a high level, been trying to do two things. First, we're just trying to figure out how to get through each day, adapting to the constantly changing situation. And second, from a long-term perspective, trying to understand what the lasting lessons are from this extraordinary and unprecedented event. We're going to explore some of those lessons today with someone who is uniquely positioned to offer critical, important insights into this moment, how we should respond to it, how we can prepare better next time, and maybe most importantly, whether we actually will prepare better next time. But there's so much more to this discussion than just that. Dr. Joanne Liu has a fascinating life story. She's currently a pediatric emergency medicine physician. She's associate professor of medicine at the University of Montreal and professor of clinical medicine at McGill University. And she is also the former international president of the highly influential international humanitarian group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. Dr. Liu has provided medical aid in some of the most difficult settings in the world. She worked with Malian refugees in Mauritania. She provided support through the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. She helped control a cholera epidemic in Haiti, came to the aid of Somali refugees in Kenya, and she stepped into conflict zones, including Palestine, the Central African Republic, and Darfur. And all of that happened because of something that she read when she was just 13 years old. In this episode of Digging Deep, Dr. Liu tells us about how she became fascinated as a teenager by a book about the experiences of a physician working with Doctors Without Borders. That was during the Soviet-Afghan War. And that's when her dream of helping people and changing the world began. But as we find out, while she may have set out with the goal of changing the world herself, it was actually the world that ended up changing her. Growing up in Quebec City as the child of Chinese immigrants, Dr. Liu was inspired early in her life by people like Gandhi and Nelson Mandela. She was an activist at an early age. You're going to hear the story of why she stopped eating Granny Smith apples when she was a little girl. Dr. Liu has a profound focus on the concept of community, and there's some great lessons in that. She has very strong feelings about how our path to success and global security and fighting off the next pandemic depends on our ability to unite as a planet. And right now, as we continue to fight COVID-19, she doesn't see many signs of that happening. She talks about the dangers of the us versus them survival instinct that kicks in during times of crisis, the fact that human beings are basically predators. But she does share her hope that we will avoid the rush for collective amnesia that tends to follow times like this. She's hopeful that we will remember the lessons instead of forgetting them, as we so often do. Dr. Liu has some incredible stories to share. Her first mission with Doctors Without Borders, which, by the way, was almost her last, how she helped to develop one of the first programs that offered comprehensive medical care for survivors of sexual violence in the Republic of Congo, and the time she transfused her own blood to save a patient's life. And she talks about a question that has always perplexed me. Are we solving any problems with humanitarian aid if it doesn't address the root cause? Liu's message is fascinating to me, that the band-aids will always be necessary even as we continue to work to find sustainable solutions. We also talk about the importance of humility, the lessons we should be taking from the COVID-19 pandemic, and why her colleagues used to call her the Ice Queen. And she tells us why, if you have a choice in life, you should always decide to be a giver and not a taker. I think you will find this to be a very, very thought-provoking conversation. I probably learned as much from this discussion as I have from any other episode of this podcast. So I hope you enjoy. One last thing before we get started, I would really appreciate it if you would subscribe to Digging Deep and also post a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Dig. It's a very quick 2-minute read with 5 really useful lessons that you can apply to your life and to your work. Lots of people are reading it every week now and enjoying it. So give it a try. You can subscribe at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. Now, let's start digging deep with Dr. Joanne Liu. Dr. Liu, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. And I've been reading about your background and your career, and I'm fascinated by the work that you do. So I'm really excited to have you join us today. Thank you very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So let's start with our rapid fire questions. What would you say is your fondest childhood memory?
Going to the zoo.
Going to the zoo. Any zoo in particular?
We were living close to a zoo in Quebec. So, and that was like the family outing, going to the zoo.
Okay. And what did you like about it?
I think it's just because we were seeing animals, and then these were not coming around that easily back then, yeah. You know, in the 70s. So I was always impressed by seeing those animals.
Who was your hero when you were 10 years old?
It's a good question. But I would think that it would have been Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela. So you knew about Nelson Mandela when you were 10?
Yeah, more or less. This is the time I started to be aware about what was going on. And I just remember when I was, it was around between me, possibly 11, but it's around that age that I decided that I could not understand why you would do that to people. To have a different way of being treated. And I was so against it that I remember telling my parents that I would stop to eat Granny Smith apples because they were coming from South Africa, which was my favorite fruit back then. And I actually stopped eating Granny Smith apples for the rest of my life.
Wow. So you've never had a Granny Smith apple since you were a child because they came from South Africa?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's a clue to what you were destined to do in so many ways, to try to change the world. So I'm fascinated by that. What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
That wasn't unclear when I was young, but I remember when I was a teenager, I was this quest for meaning, and I was looking forward to just say, how can I contribute and make this world a better world? And in some ways, I've done this sort of intense, I would say, reading adventure and journey. And I read different things. And one thing I read about was, which is one of my favorite, I would say, writer, is about Albert Camus and the plague, which is so so popular now because of the COVID-19. But and I knew that I wanted to do something to basically help people. That was one of the things that was clear.
What is your life story in 6 words?
Wow, my life story in 6 words. Daughter of immigrants, tough worker, and making it happen.
Okay. Immigrant's daughter, tough worker, making it happen. Nice. For what do you feel most grateful?
I think what I feel the most grateful about is the fact that I'm a Canadian. I always count my blessing knowing that I was raised here and I got access to the greatest education that a child can have. And I always call it the Canadian dream, which is being able to live in a place that is safe, in a place where you can educate yourself. But even more than that, it's a place where you can have dream. Yeah. That's Canada.
Absolutely. What has been the best year of your life so far and why?
The best of my life, I think it's the fact that I've been doing work, and especially when I was with Doctors Without Borders, that is so meaningful. And I always count my blessing when I was in international prison to tell myself, oh my God, waking up and knowing that you can make a bit of a difference is such a gift.
Mm-hmm. And what's been the toughest year of your life?
I don't think I had tough year, but I have possibly tough moments. And it's more about that. I still think I'm basically very, very privileged. So I don't think that I had really tough year, but I think there's some moment or tougher than others.
What one person has had the greatest impact on your life?
I've been using more like role model, and I think that in terms of role model, I was quite impressed. I would say in terms of the fight that the person did in a peaceful way was about Gandhi. When I was a teenager, I was completely mesmerized by what he has done. And the fact that he has done it in a peaceful way.
Okay. So you went from Nelson Mandela to Gandhi as you were learning about the world as a young child and as a teenager.
Yeah, I think the two of them were quite present. I had an obsession on the two of them, I think.
Hmm. Wow. What's the most important lesson you've learned that you would share with other people?
I think it's about humility. It's about being humble in front of the task that you have to tackle.
Okay. And how did you have to learn that through your work? Is that something that you discovered along the way?
Yeah, I would think so. I think that when you go to medical school, where I just remember the first word of the dean of medicine, who told us you're the cream of the crop, which I thought was really ridiculous back then. And then they somehow you get formatted on the fact that you're so great, so amazing. And then when you go in the real world, you realize it's like, Jesus, got so much things to learn.
Yeah. But that is part of the medical profession, right? Is this sort of this kind of, I mean, they talk about the kind of God complex of doctors, of some doctors, right?
Yeah, somehow. And I think that I can understand why they do that, because it's so profoundly demanding as a profession to a certain extent. And the fact that there's so much responsibility, it's the life of someone else that you have in your hands. So you have to somehow nourish some self-confidence. Otherwise, it's going to be a very, very tough journey.
Yeah. What do you think people would be most surprised to learn about you?
Most surprised. There's so many things that I'm so bad at. I'm a bad driver. I hate to order in a restaurant because it's one more decision to make. And I can be cranky.
Okay. So you're a bad driver. And you hate ordering in restaurants. So does it take you a long time to pick when you're in a restaurant?
Yeah, somehow. So I'm always happy. I remember, especially when I was in international prison, I would always say, oh, I'll take like my neighbor. It was one less decision to take in my day.
Yeah, I can relate to that. What's your secret talent?
Despite any appearances, I have some sense of humor.
Do you think people don't realize that? Is that maybe that's your best kept secret as well?
Well, a lot of people think I'm dead serious. They used to call me when I started as the international prison as the Ice Queen.
The Ice Queen. Did you convince them otherwise over time? Did you let your humor enter into the environment?
Yes, I guess I got better. I think that it's this is the way I am, especially when I'm in a foreign environment.
Yeah. What's the scariest thing you've ever done? And I mean, you've been to some really dangerous places in the world, areas of conflict, that kind of thing. But what would you say is the scariest thing you've ever done?
I think one of the scariest thing I've done is way back in the 90s, we were doing what we call exploratory mission. So this is when there is a new event or a new conflict or a new situation for a population, they send what they call an exploratory mission at Doctors Without Borders, MSF. And I was one of them who went to South Sudan during the wartime. And basically I went with another logistician and we flew in with a Cessna from Kenya, from the Kichokyo, which was the base to get into South Sudan back then. And then you flew not too high to not be basically not alert any radar. And then they left us somewhere. And they just said, we're going to come and pick you up in 1 month.
Wow.
And I just remember when the Cessna plane left, I just, oh my God, I think I'm in trouble.
Yeah. But obviously you were okay.
Yes, but the thing is, within like less than a couple of days, you know, we had to digging a hole and wait because there was so much fighting. And I'm like, oh, that might be a long journey. And I remember they told us during the briefing, if you have to leave, if you have to escape, it said you go and basically run east all the way to Ethiopia. You don't have a visa, but that's the way out. And at the pace of a Dinka are like a group of people living in South Sudan. They are really tall and very slim and very, very, you know, rough in terms of resilient, physically resilient. And I just said, well, that Dinka 1 week to get to the border, Joanne, do you probably a month.
If it takes them a week, it would take you a month. Yeah. Wow. What's your boldest prediction for the future?
I think that if we don't come together in terms of global solidarity, I really do not think that we're going to be able to face the challenges of what the 21st century is bringing to us.
So if we must unite as a planet, like the global community must unite in order to tackle those challenges?
Absolutely. And I'm saying that because I used to say that before COVID-19 pandemic, and it is very clear that the way we tackle it collectively, we didn't come together. And I know that we often say that in war, the first casualty is truth. And I think that in pandemic, the first casualty is global solidarity.
In a pandemic, the first casualty is global solidarity. Wow. Yeah, and we'll come back to the pandemic and what we've learned from it in a few minutes. But if you were giving a commencement address to a group of students today, what would be the message you'd want them to take away? What would you want to share with them?
I've done a few in my life, but I think that there's a couple of things that I've said in the past. But one of the thing is, if you have a choice in life, you should be a giver and not a taker. And I strongly believe that people who are taker is because they have no other choices. That would be one. And the second one is every individual is full of imperfection. And the way to thrive and the way to succeed in life is somehow to embrace our imperfection.
Embrace our imperfections. Wow. I like that. What has been a recent epiphany for you? Have you made a recent discovery? Have you changed your mind about something recently?
I still think that I still believe in the humankind somehow. And I still believe that that in times of crisis, it shows the best and the worst of the humankind. What I've discovered, especially with the pandemic, is the reason why we couldn't come together is the fact that I think that the human being is a survivor. And so we'll do everything to survive. which means that as well that we may be a predator to our neighbor.
Right. So the us versus them kind of survival instinct kicked in during the pandemic, and that's what we've witnessed.
Yeah, I think so.
Is there a book that has had a big impact on you? Is there a book that you're most likely to recommend to other people?
Yeah, I've talked about it before. I read it regularly. So, and it's the Plague from Camus. I just love that book. I just think that it treats every single human feeling in times of crisis.
Wow. I'll have to go back and read that again. I think I read it in school, but I don't know that I've read it since. The Plague by Albert Camus. All right. Dr. Liu, thank you for answering those questions. We are going to take a short pause, and then we will continue digging deep with Dr. Joanne Liu. We're just going to take a quick break so I can tell you a little bit more about the presenting sponsor of Digging Deep, ZenBooks. ZenBooks is Canada's go-to cloud accounting firm. They are not your typical accounting firm. I know the founders, Colin and Eric. I've worked with them for several years. And here's why I think you should consider working with them too. First of all, they bring a fresh, unique, modern approach to what is a very old-fashioned industry. These guys were working remotely and in the cloud long before it became cool. ZenBooks also uses technology to your advantage. I think this is really important. They give you the tools and analysis you need to monitor your business in real time. That's so valuable right now when everything changes so quickly. Yes, they're a virtual accounting firm, but that doesn't mean they're offshore, and it doesn't mean they're inattentive. ZenBooks combines the efficiency and effectiveness of a cloud accounting service with all the benefits that you'd want from a trusted advisor, high-level advice, and strategic support. Now, here's what I think is going to happen if you work with ZenBooks. You'll probably start out taking advantage of their cutting-edge cloud accounting solutions, but in the long run, I think you'll stay with them because of their strategic guidance and problem-solving. Among their core values, they specifically list being candid and proactive. Isn't that exactly what you want from a trusted advisor? Look, even if you're already working with an accountant or a bookkeeper, or you have some accounting staff on your team, I think you should still talk to ZenBooks and learn more about their tools and their expertise. Check out ZenBooks at zenbooks.ca. That's zenbooks.ca. Digging Deep is all about helping you make better decisions, and so is Abacus Data. Most leaders struggle to connect with and engage their audiences. Why is that? It's because they aren't sure how they think and feel and how they will react. Abacus Data can give you the strategic insights you need to make better decisions and to make them confidently. Here's a good example. A major national union was recently negotiating a new agreement for its thousands of members. This had the potential to be a very difficult process. There were many competing interests. So they brought in Abacus Data to conduct thorough and detailed research of their members to learn exactly where they stood, what they were thinking, what they wanted. And as a result, they were able to secure a strong new deal that was accepted overwhelmingly in a national vote. Abacus Data helps all of its clients understand what's really happening in the minds of their employees, clients, and stakeholders. They help them avoid costly blind spots. And they're really good at what they do. In fact, Abacus Data was one of the most accurate pollsters in the 2019 Canadian federal election. Make the one decision that will improve all of your other decisions. Let Abacus Data help you move forward with confidence and clarity. Go to abacusdata.ca. That's abacusdata.ca. Dr. Liu, thank you again for joining us. And I'm very excited to hear your perspective on a lot of things arising from the work that you've done in your career. And also, of course, the pandemic that we've all been experiencing for the last 2 years. But I wanted to talk a little more about your childhood, and you talked about being the daughter of immigrants. I'm the son of immigrants, and my mother was actually half Chinese. My grandfather was Chinese, and my mother grew up in China. So I'm really interested in that part of your story in particular, personally. But tell me about your experiences growing up in an immigrant family in Quebec City.
Well, I think that it was a different time because it's in I grew up in the late in the early 70s, basically, and so therefore, it was not as I would say multi-ethnic as the world is right now, especially in Quebec City, which was quite francophone. So this is why I'm speaking French, and the fact that I remember very well that in many instances I was the only Chinese person in a class for sure, and often in schools. So it's about growing, being different, and how do you come to terms with that is something that is that is something that you have to solve for yourself when you're small. And back then there was not as much, I would say, pop psychology where your parents will just drive you through that and then make you, you know, tell your story when you come back from school. Oh, parents didn't have time, they were working. So you have to figure that one out. So I think that these were the times that differences was more of an issue than it is today.
Yeah. So was that difficult for you? And how did you get through that? Because it sounds like, similar to many children at that time, you would have had to largely go through it on your own.
But I do think that it shaped your way of interacting with people, and it shaped your way about how you want to articulate yourself with the rest of the society, I would say. And so I remember very, very young that I realized that I am different, but I will not be unsuccessful. I don't want as well to have like a phenotype that was different, and in addition, not performing at school. And so I decided I would be good in everything very early on. I think I was like in kindergarten. I just, I'm going to kill them. I'm going to be good. And I remember being good in everything. It was ridiculous, actually, because I remember back then there were this class called religion. And it was about, because the public school were Christian by then. And I remember just, you know what, I'm going to read everything. And I remember when they had this sort of a special step when you're Christian, when you're older. And then it's in French it's called confirmation. So I don't know what it is in it.
Same thing, confirmation. Yeah.
Oh, okay, confirmation. Yeah. And so I remember they just say, well, we need someone who can read well. So we can read well. So we just said, well, Joanne, why don't you read at the mass? And although I wasn't supposed to attend, then I ended up attending and reading the passage in the Bible. So that was the way I decided to do that. I could have done completely the other way around. I could have decided that I don't want to basically get into the mold and just perform well. But that's what I decided.
Right. So was that competitiveness on your part, or was that your way of trying to fit in, was to excel at everything?
I think it was much more in a way to fit in. I just didn't want to be noticed because I was not good. So right. I thought I would be less noticed if I was good.
Yeah. So you were top of the class and everything?
Yeah.
I like that you just answered that with one word. I mean, so many people would sort of water that down in some way, but if it's the truth, yeah, great. That's what happened.
That's what happened. Yes.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate because I think that I had skills but yeah, school for me was easy.
Mm. And then I understand when you were a teenager, you read a book and that's how you became interested in Médecins Sans Frontières, which is Doctors Without Borders. Is that right?
Yeah, I read a book on the surgeon who work overseas and work in war zones. And I thought that this was the really coolest thing on earth you could do. But back then, I didn't realize that meant that I would have to do a training in medical school. But I just thought that the idea of going and working overseas in very, very difficult environment and providing care was something that was very, very appealing to me.
Yeah. And did you start talking to other people at that time? Did you tell your parents that that was what you were interested in doing?
No, because I had different interests, but that was one of the interests. But the other thing that I was quite fundamentally attached to the idea was community life and living in the community. And so when I was just after high school, I dropped from school and did Katimavik, which was the Canadian program that make you work on a voluntary basis for 9 months and you earn $1 a day. So I did that. And it was my way as well of understanding and living the concept of community.
Okay, wow. Yeah, that was a big program in the 1970s and 1980s. Yeah, started by the Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I think before you got involved with Doctors Without Borders, you went on a 3-month exchange program to Mali. Is that right?
Yes. I joined a Canadian Crossroad. It was in 1985, and I basically joined this group because, again, I wanted to live this sort of community life, but I wanted to do it overseas. And so it was a group program, not the individual program. And we went as a group, was welcome in Mali within the community, and you were living with a family there, and you were doing what we call international cooperation, but which basically, I don't think that it amount to much concretely in terms of the project. You know, we were planting tree in the desert, and I'm not sure that many of those trees have survived, but I think it was more eye-opening in terms of really understanding what it means to international cooperation at a human level.
So that was that your first big international trip then that allowed you to kind of get that experience and see another part of the world? And did that further spark your interest in doing development work and traveling, that type of thing?
I remember when I was there and we were like eating, and I remember there was always those children who were like looking at us wanting to get the leftover. And then it was a sort of a different environment where we would live today. But I just remember telling myself, I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back and work here as a doctor. And then I took the decision to go into medicine. Anyway, the decision to go into medicine crystallized when I was overseas with the Canadian Crossroad in Mali. And after that, every single choices I made in terms of training at school was in the sole objective to make sure that I would have a profession that is exportable and then making a difference. And so this is why I decided to go in pediatrics. And this is why after that, I decided to do peds emergency in New York City at NYU. The Bellevue Hospital, because I wanted to make sure that I had exposure to trauma. And because the final objective was to join Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières.
Yeah. So every decision you made about your education, about your training, was with that goal in mind?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then tell me about when you joined Médecins Sans Frontières and what that was like, because this is something you've been working towards for a really long time, obviously, since you read that book.
Yeah, so you can imagine, you know, that if you've been, I always say, if you've been caressing a dream for so many years, I think the chances that you get disappointed are really, really high. And so my first field assignment was a disaster to a certain extent. I ended up going into Mali, in Mauritania with Malian refugees. With the Malian refugees were Tuareg actually. And it was like a refugee camp of about 40,000 people. I was the only physician, but there were nurses, midwives, logistician with me. And I just remember that I have dreamt to be in overseas working and bringing care. This was a refugee camp that was stable and nothing much was happening. But what I was the most disappointed was the fact that we were not trying to solve things for the community over there that were refugee. And I remember then, and that was the reason why I decided to quit, was the fact that the person from the United Nations, UNHCR, High Commissioner for Refugee, decided that they would move the refugee camp few kilometers closer to the border of Mali. And it was in a way to just give a signal that the crisis was resolved. And he had to leave and he wanted to accomplish something before the end of his mandate. And I just remember saying, you cannot move those refugees. You can't. This is rainy seasons. If you do that and you don't have the material, the plastic sheeting for people to rebuild their housing, they're going to get sick. And we're going to have, you know, an increase in upper respiratory tract infection. It's going to be a disaster. But, you know, this was my first field assignment. So I remember back then, there was like, you have to remember, this is the early 90s. There's no emails. We send message by telex and probably nobody's reading your message. And I told the headquarters in Paris, you cannot do that. People's going to die. And nobody supported my idea. And I just decided, I will not subscribe to that. And so I just said, I'm responsible. I'm going to wait for the person who's replacing me, but I'm not going to subscribe and I'm going to leave.
And you're going to leave Médecins Sans Frontières?
So basically, yes. So I resigned and then, but I just said, I will wait for the person, replacement, because I didn't want the camp to have nobody. But I just said, you're going to do that. I said, we need to fight the High Commissioner for Refugees to tell them they're doing wrong and we have to say it publicly. And so, and I remember because I was very stubborn that I ended up being there when they were moved and I ended up seeing them, you know, standing in the rain with no plastic sheeting, waiting for the plastic sheeting to come to basically shelter themselves. And of course, you know, I could record that there was an increase in upper respiratory tract infection and then in different diseases and so anyway, I finished my mission. I have been able to prove that this happened. And I remember when I went through my debriefing to Paris, people look at me and said, oh, who's that little Canadian who thinks that she knows everything? And then basically they sort of considered that I was a bit of a troublemaker, so maybe I should not leave again. And then back then they gave you a label called NDPP, ne doit plus repartir, should not go again. And so I went back and then came back to Montreal. And I remembered after that they called me a few weeks afterwards because someone else from the headquarters went to the place. This was not, you know, the time that we are now. It was longer to arrange trip and everything. Yeah. Anyway, they went and they realized, oh my God, she's right. You know, we put them in trouble. So they called me back and they just said, you know, we're going to give you a second chance. And then you can go to Sri Lanka. And be the pediatrician there. It's close to the front line, and you're going to do a lot of emergency as well as general care and pediatrics. And I left for 6 months back then, and after that, I just kept going.
Well, that's fascinating because you ended up the international president of this organization, and you were almost out after your first experience, right?
Yes,
that's incredible. Yeah. I wanted to ask you about what it's like providing care in these environments, because there must be moments where you feel like you're making a big difference. And there must also be moments where you feel like it's all very futile. Like you're on a boat with a giant leak in it and you're just bailing water out of the boat.
Yes, it's, but that's the core of what is humanitarian aid. Humanitarian aid is about bringing support, bringing care, in this case is medical humanitarian aid, to people in the most improbable, difficult places or times of crisis. And so therefore, it's, you know that you're not addressing the root cause of what is going on. And so you have to accept that. Some people are not able to accept that. And I do understand that. And some people have been criticizing Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, for not addressing the root causes. You just say, you know, you're just putting a Band-Aid. But the reality is just say someone needs to put a Band-Aid while we are seeking more, I would say, sustainable solution. And yeah. So I think that this is two different things, because what we realized, especially in the 80s and the 90s, when there were this sort of huge, I would say, tension between sustainable solution versus temporary humanitarian response to things, is the fact that people were saying, you know, it was both approach are not useful or limited. And it's true, they are limited, but they are complementary. And then instead of fighting each other, we should have accepted that we are complementary to each other. And then that when there's especially like a novel new crisis, you need to send people right there to just make sure that people got the essential of you know, the basic things to survive, which is about food, which is about shelter, access to water and care. And after that, you need another, I would say, group of people who can as well somehow dig in terms of finding more sustainable solution.
Yeah.
But it's not one at the expense of the others. Both are needed.
Yeah. We still need Band-Aids, even as we're solving these broader issues. That's an important point. Yeah. Is it true that you transfused your own blood into a child that you were treating when you were in Mauritania?
Yeah, what happened back then is the fact that, and today we know we are very, much more cautious with our volunteers. But the thing is often when you are in the places where people are living in sort of a difficult environment, very few people are willing to give their bloods. And then it happens that I'm an O blood. And so I can give my blood almost to everybody, which is great. I'm a universal donor. So and then there was a shot, and I couldn't. You had like a big malaria crisis, and was very anemic, and we needed to transfuse a child and do a blood transfusion, and nobody was willing to do it. We couldn't find someone very very quickly in the community, and so I just said, well, let's go, let's do it. And so now, you know, when we do it, is people are not allowed to do it unless they are at the end of their mission, or they cannot do it at a certain, I would say, frequency, just to make sure that we don't get too anemic by giving too many blood volume.
Yeah, you could have, especially as a universal donor, you could have ended up doing that every day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Are there... From that time when you were going on those kinds of missions, are there particular memories that stand out for you? Are there moments that you remember that are particularly formative for you?
Well, there's so many, and in all, I think that every field assignment has his load of wise lessons. That's for sure, and so this is why I say it's so humbling, because you learn every time you go, and I'm always very very impressed by people's resilience. I'm always in awe about that, for sure. I think one of the things that remains with me a lot is because we tried to do something and we were somehow successful. A few people was about the war in 1999 in Congo, and the fact that there were so many people that the community was Congo Brazzaville, and there were like about 500,000 of people who decided to sought refuge in the forest, and they went there for about 6 months, and they were basically had limited access to food. They were saying they were eating roots of whatever vegetable they could find. So in that moment, they were very, very, I would say, deprived. And they were saying that children died of malnutrition. They called it an epidemic of malnutrition and swollen feet from the edema of being malnourished. But basically what happened after 6 months, there were some firing from a helicopter and people thought they were being delivered from the rebels. So they decided to march back to where they were coming from, which was the capital of the country, Brazzaville. And as they were walking back, they end up being attacked by the rebel one last time. And basically, most of the women end up being sexually assaulted, not only once, but twice, and often it would have been group sexual assault. So I just remembered it was so big back then that we just said, we have to do something. And I remember going and pleading at the headquarters in Paris saying, we have to do something. We have to care for those women who've been victim of sexual assault. And I remember distinctly during a board meeting, someone telling me, but Joanne, we don't die from a rape. And I said, wait a minute, this destroy people's life forever. I said, we have to give them something. We have to care for them. We have to give them the morning after pill. We have to treat the STD. We have to prevent for them to reconvert for HIV and AIDS. We give them ARVs. We have to give them mental health support. And so basically, and as well, in addition, as I just said, we need to make sure they can have access to interruption of pregnancy if they want to. And so basically, I was not really having the green light from the headquarters, and I just said, I'm just going to do it. And so we created, and then this sort of comprehensive management, because I remember when women were coming to Brazzaville, so many of them had been victims of sexual assault. They were arriving in the stadium, and there was even a sign written, rape women on the right, just to tell you the amount that we had to face. Wow. So basically we put that together. And then today, nobody remembered this was a pilot project and we had to fight for it. And it's part of the comprehensive response wherever you go in a crisis zone, that you have to make sure that women and as well men have access to sexual assault package, basically.
Wow. And, you wrote at one point that you intended to change the world, but the world changed you. Can you talk more about that? How did what changed about you? How did all these experiences change you?
Well, the thing is the fact that when you leave in your first assignment and you're full of pride of the knowledge you may have, you realize it's one thing to have the knowledge, but it's another thing to test it in real-time environment. And in real-time environment, you realize that very few of the things that you have learned can be implemented the way you thought it could be implemented. And so this is why I always call it, it's a humility exercise, because you realize that there is limit to what you have in terms of skills. It needs to be adaptable. And then what will make the difference of you to be successful or not successful is how open you're going to be towards the environment and how flexible you are ready to be as well. And the reality is often the driving force of a response are the people who are affected themselves.
Right. So you your training doesn't prepare you for what you encounter, and you have to make different kinds of decisions than maybe you expect, right?
Yeah, because the reality is we have a part of the solution, but it's a technical solution. You know, medicine to a certain extent is a technical solution to a much bigger, I would say, often political environment that you find yourself in crisis time, especially in times either of a natural disaster or a zone of conflicts. The reality is, and this is what you're facing as well today, is you often are dealing with a very complex situation, and there's no multi-dimensional, and there's no one, I would say, unidimensional response to it. There's no simple order response. It is as well complex.
Yeah. How did that change your view? How did these experiences change your view of life here in North America? Because it feels to me, when you describe and when I've read what you witnessed, you know, we're living in kind of a bubble here in the Western world of where, you know, people use the phrase first world problems, but, you know, are the things that we take for granted in our lives are the things that other people dream of having.
Well, yeah, it's always an adjustment. I just remember when people were asking me, it must be so tough to work there. And I remember when I came back from Darfur in Sudan, and I just said, actually, it's much tougher to come back. And I remember when I was coming back to readjust to the first world environment was a real challenge as well. And I remember once when I came back from Darfur, that my first shift, I sent away every single patient, except the one that I admitted in the ICU, in intensive care unit. And because I kept telling people, oh my God, your child is doing so well. And they would tell me, well, but no, but he didn't take, you know, his bottle this morning. And I'm like, well, you know, like I could not, you know, like empathize, because I'm like, well, I've seen children in E for 3 weeks, you know, when I was in Darfur. So because it was such a huge malnutrition crisis in Darfur. And I kept telling people, oh, your child is well fed. He's so well fed. So it was an adjustment. And then I end up, you know, basically you learn to step down from your high moral ground of life is so much tougher elsewhere. And then you realize that people here are feeling that distress, despite the fact that what they're facing is not at the scale of what you may have seen somewhere else in a crisis zone. But it doesn't mean that they're not distressed, and it doesn't mean that they are not suffering. And this is one of the things you have to keep reminding yourself, that you cannot judge the suffering of someone. They're the one who own it.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I mean, I can totally understand how much of an adjustment it would be coming back and working in a hospital in North America after those experiences. That's incredible. I want to talk, before we run out of time, about the pandemic that we've just been going through. You've been observing what countries around the world have done in response to the pandemic. What are the lessons in leadership and in emergency preparedness? And like, what are the lessons that you think we should take away from our experience with this pandemic?
Well, I think that we knew what we were supposed to do, because from Ebola, the outbreak from 2014 to 2016 in West Africa, it was the biggest Ebola outbreak in history that we know of, anyway, where 28,000 people end up being, more than 28,000 people end up being infected, and 11,000 people died. And after that, we made different commission and independent panel, more than 12 of them, with loads of recommendation, saying we're not prepared to respond to a global public health crisis, and these are the things we should do. And and the reality of all those recommendations that we came with, less than 10% of them were implemented. And so you could possibly take many of our report that we have written, I was part of many of those, and then change the word of Ebola for COVID-19. And, you know, 90% of what we said is probably still applied today. So what did we learn? I think that the big thing is about the fact that we didn't have a global governance of what to do when there is an existential threat at the planet level. How do we come together and how do we share resources in times of scarcity? Is there a way, a mechanic to do it? Right. And it comes back to the beginning of our conversation, is the fact that in times of crisis, the human being becomes a predator. It's one for oneself. So that's what we knew about that, but we didn't know to which extent we were such a survivor. And so for me, it's important that, and this is why I'm part of the independent panel on pandemic preparedness and response. And one of the things is we need to come together to have a mechanic to respond to those kind of global threats. And we do hope that COVID-19 will be what we call the Chernobyl moment, that we think it was such a disaster that we're gonna put aside our domestic national interests for the greater good of the planet. And this is why we just say, it needs to be elevated at the head of state in terms of how to govern the response of those kind of crises. And then we need to finance it. And we need to make sure that the tools that we will develop in terms of research and development, talking about vaccine or diagnostic or treatment, needs to be a global public good. Not like it is right now, still a monopoly from pharmacy. And if right. you can afford it, you have it. If you cannot afford it, you don't have it. And you're at the back of the queue. So all those things we have predicted them, I don't think that for someone who's been part of all those simulations at world level, I realized that we were lacking imagination how greedy the world will be in times of crisis.
Are you frustrated? Are you disappointed that we didn't learn the lessons from the previous crisis?
We say not frustrated, but I'm disappointed. But what I'm the most concerned about is about our future and the fact that I do hope that we will not commit what I call the double fault, which is not being ready and not learning.
Yeah.
And I think that right now it is very, very a hard sell to tell people we need to do a postmortem or analysis of what happened to make sure next time around we're better prepared. But what happened most of the time after such a collective trauma, there's a rush for collective amnesia. People want to move on. And we see it right now, is people are saying, I am done with COVID-19. I want to move on with my life. And that would be, I would say, that would be the biggest mistake if we were to do that. But the reality is most likely what will happen.
Wow. And what about that dynamic you describe, that survival instinct that forces us to turn on each other? We've seen that so much, even just the divisions that have been exposed in Canada between the people who are in favor of vaccine mandates and those who are opposed and how they relate to each other now. Even though I have very strong opinions and support vaccine mandates, I feel like we're not showing enough compassion for the people who don't, or understanding of how they got there. And if we are simply vilifying them, that's not going to bring them closer to understanding our point of view. So what is it that we can learn about that instinct, about that predatory instinct that you describe?
Well, I think it's quite normal, but I think there is a huge role in terms of people who are in power during times of crisis. And one of the things that we have shown, and we actually shown it with Ebola, but we again have shown it with COVID-19, is the fact that we've looked at all the indicator and all the performances of different countries. And one of the key things that makes a difference from a nation to do better than another one is the trust in general, trust toward your government, trust between individual. And that's what will give a nation a better chance to perform better. And how do you get there? There's two ingredients. It's risk communication, which means that you communicate clearly what you know, what you don't know, and what you would like to know. And then the other thing is about the community engagement. It's the people need to own the epidemic or the pandemic. And I always call it the secret weapon in a pandemic. When people on the board, things change, things move on. And so I do hope that we're going to learn those lessons. We repeated them in different way, in different format, but it's always the same thing. It's always about trust. It's about transparency. And it's about getting the people on board. Three ingredients, simple.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we need to do differently going forward? What other advice do you have about how we handle these kinds of crises in the future?
It's a question of crisis management, and I don't think that we are experienced with that, because we have crises, but not to that scale. And I think that straight from the beginning, in many places, we have underestimated the virus, and then we have looked for some wishful thinking. We've made the dramatic, I would say, mistake of basing our scenario on the best case scenario instead of the worst case scenario. And so therefore we were always short in terms of response. And we never been able in many places to get into the comfortable situation of being proactive. We were always reactive on something that was ahead of us. And that's very unfortunate. And I do hope right now that as we are pulling ourselves out of the grip of COVID-19 in part of the world, especially in high income country, that this will not become the pandemic of the low income country. And we're gonna, do everything to pull ourselves out collectively from that, because we all know about the risk of variant and the emerging of variant. If the virus run loose in the community, it can mutate and then give rise to an emerging variant like Omicron. And next time we might not be as lucky as with Omicron. But it's about as well acknowledging that we're so interconnected and interdependent that we need to get to the finish line all together.
Do you think there are enough rewards in the system for that to happen? Because what I worry about is there are no political rewards for being proactive. There are no political rewards for avoiding a crisis like this if people never find out that the crisis was avoided. If we'd done something to prevent COVID-19, we'd never know what we missed, right? So I'm worried that the way our politics and our governance are structured, that it's difficult to imagine how we would be more preventative in the future.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is why people who are doing preventive medicine, I always say it's a hard sell. Because if you're not able to communicate and show what would be the negative impact on people, it's going to be very hard to create the traction. And that is very unfortunate. And this is why it's hard to tell people you need to invest every year collectively a few billion dollars to basically save trillions of dollars. They're not ready to do that.
And to save potentially thousands or millions of lives too.
Yeah, to save lives and to save as well livelihoods of people. Yes. And the thing is, this is why I'm so puzzled by that, because when was the last time collectively that we put on pause our life for 2 years, personally, professionally, and when was the last time that we could not congregate? When was the last time that we let our loved one, especially our elder one, dying alone in a hospital with people wearing protection I don't know. It's just if we don't, it doesn't, bottom line for me, if this doesn't create the traction to get together and do better, I don't know what will, honestly.
Well, I hope it does provide the incentive for us to think and act differently going forward. Dr. Liu, this has been really fascinating and enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us today, and congratulations, and thank you for all the work that you've done around the world.
Thank you very much.
That is Dr. Joanne Liu. What an incredible life story. And there are so many themes and messages that I have taken away from this conversation, how she intended to change the world, but the world changed her, how trust will give us a better chance when we're in times of crisis, how what she has seen in other parts of the world has affected her view of life in North America, why we need Band-Aids, how we should embrace our imperfections. And the bottom line is I'm just really, really impressed by how incredibly focused, driven, and accomplished Joanne Liu is. So once again, a big thank you to Dr. Joanne Liu for joining us on Digging Deep. And if you enjoyed this episode, I have a favor to ask you. Please review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please send it to a couple of people you think would enjoy it. That will help us reach more listeners and produce more great episodes. And one last thing, if you want to keep digging deep into topics and lessons like this, I have a weekly newsletter that I send out. I know your inbox is probably overflowing right now, but I promise you, this email is very quick and it's right to the point. It's 5 very short items that I've discovered each week. It takes about 2 minutes to read, and it has some great lessons from experts like Dr. Liu that you can apply immediately. So please subscribe to the newsletter at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. And get ready for more great stories and powerful lessons on the next edition of Digging Deep. Thank you for listening.
Have you ever thought, I'd love to have a podcast just like this one? Well, I can help. My name is Matt Kundel, and everyone at my company, the Sound Off Podcast Network, had a hand in making this show. Whether it was about the sound, the discoverability, or that you're just enjoying the show, we are all about the detail. If you think you have a podcast in you, reach out to me via email, matt@soundoff.network, or check out the website and become one of the great podcasts we work with at soundoff.network.